off because, you know, the control placement is going to be different. Won't need the fan switch or any of the other stuff. So I'll put a 19-inch rack panel on there, and there's no, the case is gone. So it'll go into a rack cabinet, but first thing I have to do is fire it up and make sure that the power supply is basically sound, and then we can go on from there. I understand what you're saying, Dick. It's you know, I'm really not sure what tube lineup I'm gonna go with. The 8877, the big drawback is the price, but what it is I guess I feel at home with that tube because I've got two of them running in that behemoth of mine, and it's just something, you know, I guess it's human nature. We all like to work with things we're familiar with. By the way, did you get my photograph, Dick and Mel?
I sure did. That was a beautiful reconstruction, refurbishing you did. That copper chassis ended up so nice and shiny looking. What did you do to make the chassis look that good? Did you then have to spray it with something like a Krylon or something better to make sure it didn't retarnish with the copper oxide? How did you make that copper chassis look so good, Rich? Go ahead.
Dick, I stripped that whole transmitter down. The hardware, I replaced it all. It was corroded. I put new hardware. To clean up the chassis, I used a metal polish called Flitz. F-L-I-T-Z. I bought it at a gun store in Whitestone. They use it for polishing guns. It comes in a tube, F-L-I-T-Z, and it comes from Germany.
And do you have to do any further protection to make sure a copper oxide doesn't build up later? Or is the waxing of that material giving it the protection from then on?
Well, I didn't coat it with anything, and it looks good. It hasn't oxidized yet.
Very good. Now, let me go back to the previous subject for one more comment, Rich. You're a guy who has the resources to once in his life, twice in his life, go out and buy $1,200 tubes. There's a hell of a lot of amateurs out there who don't feel that they're that well off. If you go a little bit slowly and do this research so that you can choose Russian-made tubes, Svetlana's, or surplus 4CX250Bs, whatever. If you try to go at this project in an economic way so that you get near the performance you want, it doesn't have to be exactly 1,500 watts of output. 700 watts, 800 watts of peak envelope power output on 6 and 2 meters is still an extremely popular amplifier. In fact, the size of the power supply that eventually could be put on that would be nice and portable and running from a 110-volt line. And if you can make it such a way that it can be driven with some of the other rigs that we've all got, the 30-watt class of rigs on 6 and 2 meters, all of a sudden you're going to have an amplifier that a lot of guys are going to want to duplicate. A company eventually is going to be formed to take your design and mass produce it. There's a big hole in high-power amplifiers for that frequency range right now as I see it. Guys can get up to the 100-watt level. Let me drop by solid state. With a Stucci 12-volt power supply, they can get up to the 100-watt level, maybe even a little bit beyond that on 2 meters. I guess you can get up to the 250-watt level, but they're starting to get kind of rare. But to get to the kilowatt level with solid state is essentially out of the question. To do it with tubes is a very friendly amplifier. The solid state amplifiers at the kilowatt level become very unreliable, and if you transmit into an open circuit relay for a millisecond, it's gone. You wiped out the silicon. You do that with a tube, it'll laugh at you for 5 solid minutes, if you know what I mean. There's a lot to be said at the kilowatt level, at that frequency range, with tubes. The power supplies are a lot easier. Things are a lot more understandable. The instrumentation is there, and so on. So guys can reproduce it. So I think you're on the threshold of what could become an extremely popular subject, amplifier project, and do think economically. Note the fact that you can afford it. Think about the other guys that would like to reproduce it who don't have a fat pocketbook. Let's see what Bernie's got to say on all this. K2IO, K2RAW in the TechNet. I heard Bernie sign in.
Oops, sorry about that. Rich, is it possible that you could post those pictures someplace? on your QRZ page or something like that. And also, Dick, one of the listeners over the links that can't get in, Jesse, was asking, what was the tube again? Could you repeat the spec numbers of the tubes that you were recommending, Dick?
Yeah, my favorite tube is 4CX250B, 4 Charlie X-ray 250B, an extremely popular tube on the surplus market in the 70s and 80s. It's got 17 decibels of gain, full power output capability to 500 megacycles, and if you use it on 6 and 2 meters in grounded cathode service, 1 or 2 watts of drive will give you full power output on that tube, maybe 3 watts of drive, in that order. So it's got a lot of capability, and those tubes on the surplus market used to sell for numbers like $5 and $10. I'll admit that brand new now, they're more in the $250 class, but that tube was so popular, it is so available, so many people have got it on the shelf, and if you don't abuse that tube, it lasts forever. The tubes that I owned in 1970, 4CX250B, I am still using them today, and they're producing 95% of the power output. So if you don't abuse that tube, it's a very rugged tube, 250 watts plate dissipation. Move enough air through that tube, like I did in the parallel kilowatt amplifier. April and May 1972, QST magazine. April and May 1972, you look at the so-called parallel air cooling arrangement where you force the tube to have its air flow in a slightly different way. You think the tube is rated for 250 watts. It will dissipate 500 watts per tube if you move enough air through that tube. It's a very conservatively rated tube. And so a Frank Toner, F9FT, 4CX250B, is a paralism and a parallel kilowatt amplifier on 432, was getting 2,000 watts output key down on 432 just by using a little more air, a little bit more
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
By using a little more air, a little more drive, and a little more voltage. And the tubes would take it. That was his moonbound setup. 2,000 watts output, a pair of 4CX250Bs, and he did it for a couple of years on end. And that's that's the least expensive, high-power, high-gain tube I know of. And so I know you like 8877 and some of these other tubes. At least give that one some consideration, Rich, as I see it. Properly used, it's got all kinds of reserve capability that people don't know about. The only way you can destroy that tube is to make the screen dissipation exceed 12 watts, and then you'll destroy that tube in a couple of seconds. As long as you've got a protection circuit looking at screen grid current, and you keep the screen grid dissipation with your protection circuit below 12 watts, and there's some very simple ways of doing that with a resistor, that tube will last forever. So give it some thought. Hey, with any further comments on this subject of Rich's very exciting 6 and 2 meter high power amplifier, give me a call, let us right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else? You've got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I just really wanted to mention this, this coaxial triode one more time, because I'm not too sure that many people are really aware that this tube is out there, but I've been playing with it for a couple of months, you know, just a little off and on, just to see what this thing will do, and it's pretty amazing. And the tube is a GS31B, and it typically can run on a 3,000-volt power supply. It can draw a maximum cathode current of 1.4 amps. Its anode dissipation is a kilowatt. You can drive the maximum grid power up to 22 watts, and this thing has got an operational frequency range of up to 1 gigahertz. So, I mean, you can actually tune the circuits around the outside of this thing and work it on HF, VHF, UHF. Very, very interesting tube. Somebody really wanted to play with a tube and was, I mean, the hardest thing to get around with this tube is mounting the coaxial sockets and mounting it. But I mean, outside of that, if you get the right socket for it and you plug this thing in, I think your chance of jumping right to success is pretty quick. So I think it's something to at least, consider. That's the, GS31Bs. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
earlier, earlier you said that that tube is $75, and I think it's a coaxial type. In other words, it's got rings for the screen grid, control grid, if there's a screen grid, control grid, cathode. Everything is a ring, even the plate circuit is a kind of a ring. And so guys building microwave cavity type amplifiers with that tube use finger stock to make a homebrew socket. To your knowledge, does anybody make a commercial socket for that tube? Because for Rich to try to come up with a mechanical design that homebrews the finger stock coaxial socket, it's going to be a little bit of a pain. Do you think anybody makes a commercial socket that tube can be plugged into at 6 2 meters? Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, there's quite a few available, Dick. One, from that store, Radio Component, they have the sockets. You can get them from them. But even mounting the socket isn't the easiest thing in the world. It's not the most user-friendly kind of a thing. But, you know, if you see one of these sockets, you can kind of figure out how to mount it. But it's not as straightforward as, you know, like two little holes you got to drill into a cabinet and bolt it down. So it takes a little bit more than that. But here again, it's... you can get them, and if you ask around, even some of the like RF parts, they can get a hold of them. So if you ask, do a little bit of asking around your typical tube suppliers, they can come up with those sockets. They are out there. But then again, they might be as pricey as the tube. You might spend $75 for the tube, but you might have to pay another $75 for the socket. But still, for a kilowatt tube, single amplifier, $150 investment isn't the worst thing in the world, you know? It's kind of interesting. Very impressive tube, and you want to talk about robust. This thing can take a lick and keep up ticking. Because while I've been playing with it, I haven't put it in actual operation yet, but, you know, just tuning it into misloads and steady loads and all kinds of things, and this is probably one of the most stable tubes I've seen in a long, long time.
Glenn, is that a triode, and are you running it in ground and grid service?
Yes, it is, Rich.
Roughly how much drive do you think it requires, Glenn?
Well, I've been finding that that's kind of proportional to the voltage that you run it at. You have to move that up and down a little bit, but I think you can drive it. It's a very, very linear tube. I think you could drive it with very, very light power, a few watts and start getting output power out of it. So to really drive it up there, you know, to a full kilowatt, I think the gain rolls off as you get more and more output power out of it. That's what I've been seeing, at least anyway. So it compresses a little bit at the top, but if you want to use it, back it off and run it like at a 500 watt output level, that thing's going to cruise all day long with probably just, I'd say probably like 25 watts in, Dick.
So you believe quite possibly 25 watts of cathode drive on this grounded grid service of this Russian-made tube, GS-31B, which is one of the very popular ones. You believe 25 watts of drive is likely to be 500 watts peak envelope power output, which would be 13 decibels of gain, and that sounds like a very likely number. So I think you're saying you see evidence of that, and I think you said it runs on 3,000 volts on the plate, which is very close to the exact voltage that Rich already has on his SB220 power supply. Back to you for a confirmation on that, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, how soon is your amplifier going to be on the air?
I'm still in the experimenting stage with these tubes. I'm having so much fun with them, playing with them, kind of in a broadband application. It's just I've kind of made a test jig, and the numbers that I gave you, Dick, are basically measurements. And now I think, you know, if you back this down, from what I saw, like running it down like around the, 25, 30 megahertz area, I think it's going to be probably closer to 17 dB a gain. But, up around, 2 meters to 440, I think the 13 dB is probably a little more accurate. You know, the gain is rolling off as the frequency is moving up. But then again, that might also be my tuning circuit. You know, my tuning circuits might not be the most efficient either. So, you know, I'm just kind of giving you, like, roundabout numbers. You know, so this isn't something that's in stone just yet. But from what I've seen, very, very robust.
Yeah, I hope that Rich has the opportunity to go slow on the selecting of the tube and socket and finds a combination that's not expensive and can run at the kinds of drive levels that quite a few of the rigs that already exist. Yeah, some of the rigs do have 100 watts output, but an awful lot of them have only got 30 watts of output, 30, 50 watt class, and solid state at these frequencies is nowhere, at these power levels, 500 watt power level, are very non-forgiving tubes are extremely forgiving, as long as they got the right kind of a minor protection network. If it's a screen grid tube, you got to worry about screen dissipation. And with a triode tube, you got to worry a little bit about grid dissipation. If you make the mistake of driving the cathode with grid bias present and no plate voltage, that's the condition where you could over-dissipate the control grid on a triode tube. You got to be a little bit careful about that. But there's ways you can make a circuit that senses the control grid current that occurs during that service and goes into a protection mode by way of sufficient resistance on the bias network or by way of a current maximum detector that kills the drive and so on. So the grids on these tubes are the only thing that's vulnerable as long as you're moving some air through them. Other than that, they're extremely rugged and will take a short circuit or an open circuit output until the cows come home. You try doing that with solid state, and it's game over real fast. Okay. The next person who had a question or a comment was Howie. Go right ahead, Howie. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, WB2HWW. You copy me okay, Dick?
Beautiful right now.
We were talking about last week a antenna made out of a coax cable, and that was in QEX. The quarter wave radiating element was just the center conductor, and then you went down another quarter wave with the coax, and then you went into a choke. My question is, will the length of the quarter wave, the bottom quarter wave, which has the shield on it, will that be affected by the velocity factor? Will the overall length of this antenna be affected by the velocity? So you just can't use, 468 divided by 2, 468 divided by the frequency, or 234 divided by the frequency. That's 95% of the velocity factor. Would you have to take into account the velocity factor of the cable, because quarter wave section of that cable is the dielectric and all the stuff in the cable, Dick? Go ahead.
Yeah, darn good question, Howie, and you're going to be happy with the answer. No. Let me show you why. By the way, in order to save the slightly more expensive coaxial cable, the way this guy did it is that the center of the half-wave dipole, he just simply opened up the coax cable in that area, center conductor and shield. He then put a quarter wavelength long, without velocity factor, piece of copper for the radiator. He left the shield connected to nothing. He goes on the shield, on the outside of the coax cable, back a quarter wavelength in air, and constructs the multi-turn RF choke out of the coax cable with a capacitor across that multi-turn coaxial cable choke, capacitor across it to resonate it. Each half of that antenna is operating in air. The signal flowing down the center of the coax cable is experiencing the velocity factor. But until it hits the open circuit end of the coax cable, the center of the dipole, what the velocity factor is on the inside doesn't matter. And from there on, everything is in air. The radiator is a quarter wavelength piece of copper. The outer shield of the cable is a slightly lower than velocity factor because of the polyethylene outer jacket, but that's an extremely minor factor. This is an extremely forgiving antenna. You could, if you want to, let me drop, intentionally make it slightly longer or slightly shorter in order to adjust the resistive component if you wanted to, and then get partial compensation by taking that resonating choke of the coils of, I think it's five turns of coax cable with a capacitor across it, slightly tuning it high or low in order to correct for the reactance component. What we're describing is the latest issue of QEX magazine, the July-August issue 2010, the article on page 35. I went to arrl.org to see if I could download this article, and it's not yet available on the archives. They're not that up to speed, if you know what I mean. It's going to be another couple of months before this article is available. So You have to find somebody who gets QEX magazine. But from the description, you can see that the construction of this thing is not that elaborate. And now whether you use this as a horizontal dipole or a vertical dipole, doesn't matter. It's a slightly easier way of making a J-pole-like antenna, if you like. It's a convenient way of taking a simple piece of coax cable and getting a extremely nice, let me drop, extremely nice impedance match to a dipole, and you're feeding the dipole mechanically from the end, but electronically, you're feeding it from the center. What could be more ideal? Except, I'll admit that it's a little bit more complicated to make a horizontally polarized dipole in this manner, but if you want a vertically polarized dipole on any band that you can consider, and you're willing to hang the end of this thing with a piece of cable, a piece of a rope, up to the top of a tree, the top of the tower, a field day site, whatever, use it as a sloper, I can see a lot of capability for this antenna. I wonder if this makes a little more sense to you now, Howie. W2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes. No, it makes sense. I was just curious. It was just an academic question. Would you have to worry about the velocity factor? But you can always tune it. That's what I was worried about at the bottom end of it. And, you know, they make coaxial verticals. I think Cellwave used to make them, something like that, a coaxial vertical Cellwave. And they had a... And they put four little radios at the bottom to act as a choke. So they make them in the low band fashion. But I was just curious if you had to worry about the velocity factor. That's why I asked the question, Dick. So what you're saying is that not really, because you're radiating on the shield, and it's just basically the dielectric of the insulation between the shield and the outer conductors, you know, to the outer world. So that's not going to have much of an effect.
Yeah, this half-wave dipole fed mechanically at one end is a little bit like the so-called bazooka antenna, which people have used in the past, where you literally take the center conductor and dielectric and strip back the braid for a quarter wavelength, and then you fold back the braid a quarter wavelength back down the outside of the coax cable. Well, if you actually try to really do that with modern-day coax, mechanically, that's a very difficult thing to do, to take, let me pick a number, 16 or 32 feet of braid and fold it back on itself. The way you've got to stretch the braid, it won't let you do that. You don't have to do any braid stretching arrangement in this thing. You just simply cut off the cable, just open up the end of the coax cable, add a center conductor for the right quarter wavelength of length, mechanically supported. The outer braid, just leave it as is, do nothing at the end, go down a quarter wavelength toward the shack, so to speak, make this coil, put a capacitor across the coil, and now that is a half-wave dipole that requires no ground plane radials at all. Properly designed, that RF choke, it is a perfect resonator, a parallel circuit LC resonator, similar to what Wesley was talking about earlier, which represents thousands of ohms of impedance. No RF energy flows down the rest of the coax cable into the shack, and now this is a truly half-wave dipole antenna, electronically fed from the center, not from the end, but mechanically fed from the bottom end. So to hang this thing vertically, horizontally, as a sloper or whatever, it can't be any simpler mechanically, can't be any higher performance electronically. Wow, how come we haven't thought of this extremely simple idea earlier? Extremely well done article.
Go ahead, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric. I mean, Howie.
You could do is you could take a vertical whip or a vertical pipe, then the other quarter wave section could be a PVC pipe, and your cable could be in the middle, and at the bottom of the thing, you can wrap it up in a coil. So you could actually make a vertical antenna very easy. You wouldn't even need an insulator. You just take a quarter wave, you take a little more than a quarter wave piece of PVC pipe, mount the whip on top. That whip could either be a whip or it could be a slightly thinner diameter pipe. And then at the bottom, you just put your coil exactly a quarter wave down from the feed line. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, you're using the PVC pipe as a method of forcing this thing into a support where you brace it from the bottom. If you were doing this on 80, 40, or 20 meters, and you're doing it at a field day site, to hang the thing vertically from the outer tip of the radiator is something worth doing. The only thing mechanically you've got to do is build a little bit of an arrangement where the coax cable ends and the quarter-wave resonator begins. Build some kind of a plastic resonator there. The article shows you how to do that in order to hold that all together so that when you're mechanically tugging on the top of the radiator, because you're hanging this thing vertically, as long as you've got a support that's nearby, you don't have to support it from the bottom. You can hang it from the top. And so you just have to mechanically create some strengthening right at the coax cable to...
This could be a very nice 6 or 10 meter or even a 2 meter antenna. This could be, you know, you could make something small. This could be like a coaxial type of dipole for 6 or 2 meters or even 10 meters.
Yeah, Mel was having us answer the question for an inexpensive antenna for a beginner, where we were telling him about a SO239 classic quarter-wave ground plane with the four radials coming out of the connector and the one radiator coming out of the center. Is that a simpler antenna than this one? That's a toss-up. Although this is a little bit unconventional and a little bit not popular up till today, this antenna has got a lot to be going for it. This might actually be simpler and cheaper to build. The only thing you need is that transmitting rated capacitor that's across the coil. Although the article didn't say so, a smart guy can build a kilowatt rated transmitting capacitor by using nothing but an open wave, an open quarter wave, less than quarter wave piece of coax cable as a stump. So with another piece of coax cable acting as the capacitor put across the coil at the bottom of this antenna, this whole antenna consists of nothing but pieces of coax cable. The center conductor, if you want to, could be the real center conductor of the coax cable with its dielectric material left on for weatherproofing, if you like.
Or comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
You wouldn't even need a capacitor if you were able to adjust the length of the top quarter wave section, because you can adjust it for the best SWR. Do you agree with that?
Negatory. The way this antenna is being built, it is a true half wave in space with no velocity factors being considered anywhere. The choke at the bottom, because the outer end of the dipole is a few thousand ohms of impedance, you're trying to create a choke of more than a few thousand ohms of impedance. To make the choke out of a coax cable that is resonated with a capacitor across it, to make it 10 or 100,000 ohms of impedance, very easy. To do it as a pure choke, that's a lot of turns of choke at 80 meters, if you know what I mean. You're way ahead of the game to resonate it. And once you decide you're going to resonate it, you can either put a transmitting rated capacitor, air-type variable capacitor there if you want to, but the smarter guy is going to make it out of a coaxial stub, because a coaxial stub used as a capacitor can easily take multi-kilowatt level. Does that make a little more sense, Howie, KQLIW?
Okay. Yes, I understand what you're saying. You're saying that even though because you're feeding it from the end, it's going to have a higher impedance. You don't want, I see, you have to isolate it somehow, so you don't want the signal to flow backwards. All right. So you still need a very high impedance choke to RF at that point. There's no way. Because you know what? Trying to put a capacitor, that's going to make it mechanically a little bit more difficult. I was trying to see, is there a way to do this without having a capacitor across that coil? That's all. So you just can't go out and buy a 50-ohm ballon or something, or a 300-ohm ballon, and put it there and not, you know, right at the bottom. Could you do that with a commercial ballon, Dick? Or are you still going to need to have a capacitor?
I definitely do not recommend a commercial ballon to be used there, Howie, with ferrite, because the voltages there are huge when you're running, let me think, a number, 100 watts of power. The outer voltage on the tip of a dipole hits many thousands of volts. Many many thousands of volts on a commercial union, what am I thinking of, a balloning device there, would be the equivalent of putting a ballon into an antenna that's got a 500 to 1 standing wave ratio. They are not rated for that performance at the 100 watt level. Any of the ballons you and I can buy are meant to go into an antenna where at the feed point, at the end of the ballon, they want to see 50 or 75 ohms with, let me pick a number, less than 3 to 1 standing wave ratio. You put a 500 standing wave ratio there, as you would in this service, and you no longer can guarantee the performance of the ballon, you're likely to burn it up. So ferrite in this location is not appropriate because the voltages are extremely high. But making an air coil out of a multiple turns, 3 or 4 turns, 5 turns of coax cable around a soda bottle, that's the way they did it in the article, and then put an air variable capacitor across it, and they weren't quite smart enough to go the next step, let me drop, of making that transmitting rating capacitor out of a stub of coax cable. Very, very.
Comment, Dick, again?
Yeah, go ahead.
So we're not using this as a transmit antenna, but as a receive antenna, then you could use a ballon. If you weren't going to transmit 100 watts to this or 500 watts to this, you wouldn't even need a capacitor if this was a receive antenna only, right?
You'd like the antenna to be well-tuned to your particular band. You'd like it to present a low standing wave ratio. Yes, what you're saying is that a receiver is extremely forgiving. You can put an antenna with a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio on a receiver, and although you don't move the S-meter quite as much on HF frequencies, you'll get full performance as a receiver, but you can't transmit through it. It's so easy to put that capacitor across the coil, I wouldn't fight that one, Howie. Yes, you've got to be a little bit careful about weatherproofing it. Although if you make the capacitor out of a stub or coax cable, even there, weatherproofing becomes extremely simple. So you have to admit that the outer end of a dipole has thousands of ohms of impedance. When you're doing it by a series fed, outer fed coax cable into the outer end of the dipole, you want to create a choke there of tens of thousands of ohms of impedance. Resonating it does it beautifully. Doing it as a pure choke, I don't recommend it. But you could do it as a partial choke with ground plane radials. That's another variation of this antenna. A half wave radiator with a choke at the bottom and some ground plane radials. That's another variation. But the purist will do it as a resonated choke and a pure half wave antenna in free space, no velocity factors to be considered anywhere, no ground plane radials required. Hang it vertically with a piece of rope on any high support you've got in the neighborhood. And so for a field day site, this could be an ideal antenna, in my opinion. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call at us right now. K2LAW in the TechNet.
I had another question about the analyzer.
Okay, you're on the list, Wesley, and we haven't finished this particular subject yet, and we do have one other person ahead of you, and that is Press. Whiskey 2, Papa Whiskey. Anyone else with any further comments on this NFED antenna? Page 35, latest issue, QEX Magazine, July, August issue, 2010. Give me a call at us right now, K2RAW on the TechNet.
Yeah, K2RAW. I got one more comment. If you look at an Antron doesn't use a capacitor, but somehow they use a tap coil. Couldn't you make a tap coil? Because I could see having an issue with a variable cap outside. So would there be a way to tap this thing so you could use a fixed capacitor?
I think the answer is almost no in the pure form of this antenna. This is a pure, full, half-wave dipole in free space, electronically fed at the exact center, mechanically fed from the outer tip. A pure vertical structure that everywhere has almost the same diameter as the coax cable, except in the vicinity of the coil of coax cable at the bottom of the antenna. So, no, in the way this article was intended, you want to put a capacitor there. And because you can take a fixed transmitting capacitor, put it across the coil, and then either stretch or shrink the turns of the coil, because you've wrapped them onto a plastic soda bottle, You stretch or shrink those coils to increase or decrease the amount of inductance, therefore you force it into resonance, and it's easy to measure the resonance with your grid dip meter. So it doesn't have to be an air variable capacitor. It can be a fixed capacitor, and you can still force it to resonate at your frequency. I wonder if you see that, Howie. Go ahead.
Comment, N2MB.
Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, this is primarily designed to be a pure vertical antenna, or how would it work if you strung it out horizontally?
Funny you should ask. When you look at your July-August issue of 2010 of QEX magazine, and you go to the third page of the article, page 37, you will see them using this as a horizontal dipole. They had two vertical supports for the dipole, not supported in the center. One of them has the coax cable going up there. The other one is the mechanical support for the tip of the antenna. So there's nothing stopping you from using this horizontal, even though you're feeding it from the outer edge. Over to you, Barry.
Okay, yeah, that's good for, certainly there's a lot of reasons why that would be advantageous for a lot of people. Sometimes if they want a dipole, they're not exactly in the middle of it on 75 or 160 meters. So they'd want to do this horizontally. That might be an advantage. And of course, 80-meter verticals take up a lot of room.
Now, for a guy like you with a nice high support tower, you could run the coax cable up to the peak of the tower, and then the tip of the dipole doesn't have to run out horizontal. You can run it as a sloper, tip down the tip with a piece of coax, with a piece of rope down to some support on the house or the ground, if you like. Or the hold-on thing could be a sloper where the tip is supported from the top of the tower, and the coax cable comes down at a slanted angle or down the tower if you like. However, for a guy like you with all kinds of good high mechanical supports, let me drop. Because this antenna is so inexpensive to produce and so mechanically cute from my point of view, nothing's stopping you from building an array of these things where it becomes a bipolar or a four-directional antenna, depending on whether you build a pair of them a quarter wavelength apart, and you feed them in phase or out of phase, in leading and lagging. You've got four directions you can select. Or build even a greater number of them and make it an all-fed, multiple-element Yagi array. Because the actual elements themselves are so easy to tune high or low in frequency, like directors, or to feed them in various combinations, you can make all kinds of fancy electronic direction finding or direction sending with this antenna. I wonder if you see the possibilities of that one, Barry. N2 Moon Bounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm going to give it back to TechNet, but that's exactly why I was asking the question, because that's precisely what I was thinking of doing, is along the lines of just what you said, of phasing them and then being able to possibly electronically adjust them to change direction. Back to you, N2MB.
Hey, you got your audio volume set just right tonight. Quite often when you flip over to the FM mode, the audio is a little bit too hot. What made it so good tonight, Barry? Go ahead.
I must have done something wrong. That's all I can think of. I got something adjusted wrong to sideband. That's it.
You must have been a little bit light on sideband, not quite as heavy on the speech compressing. So, okay. Anybody have any further questions on this rather cute dipole arrangement? And I'm signing to say, how come somebody hasn't thought of this one earlier? It's so cute and so effective. Anybody with any further comments, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
UJO.
I heard UJO and somebody else. So UJO first, go ahead.
Okay, this is Tony, KCUJL. I know Barry. He's a good friend of my buddy of mine that passed away. His name was Wally. And I wanted to say hello to Barry. Barry, how you doing?
Okay, real good. I don't want to take up net time. We can discuss this afterwards. But it's good to hear your voice. But let me get back, because this is a net, and there's a lot of people on tonight, I noticed. And to Mike Bravo.
Okay. Because I installed a 100-foot tower. I need a 40-gauge steel pipe. The first section of 20-foot of that pipe was 6-inch pipe. Each other.
Okay.
Went up to 100 feet where there was a four-element beam, And what he did after we guided the two top sections, he dropped the antennas, which you call the feed lines, from the top of that the tower down to the ground. And he ran 160 meters and 80 meters and 420 meters run right from the tower. He even turned the tower itself, being that it was galvanized steel, he turned the tower itself into an antenna. KC2UJL.
Sounds like a fun project there, Tony. Who was the other person who signed in the same time as Tony?
KC2WGB, John Staten Island.
Go right ahead, John.
Good evening to everyone on the net. Dick, I have a quick question. On that antenna you're describing, the coil that is placed at the end of that, with the capacitor across it, does it have to be right at the end of the antenna, or could it be at the bottom of the antenna line, sort of in the shack?
I don't think you want to put the coil in the shack, because then your whole length of coax cable is hot RF-wise. Most of the time, you're not going to want that. So once again, this thing is, in one possible embodiment, you're taking center conductor and dielectric material, a quarter wavelength of it, exposing it, removing the shield entirely. Then you walk back another quarter wavelength on the shield of the cable toward the shack, and you create this coil. And you create this coil of the coax cable. You didn't open the coax cable, per se. You just coil the coax cable at that point around a soda bottle, a plastic soda bottle, four or five turns. That is an inductor. You put a capacitor across that inductor to resonate it. Yes, you have to dig through the outer polyethylene, the polyvinyl chloride jacket of the coax cable into places to get down to the outer shield in order to solder the two points of the capacitor. But you're resonating the coil of coax cable a quarter wave away from the center of the dipole. So the dipole now consists of, let me drop, the center conductor and dielectric of the cable a quarter wavelength in free air. You come back from that point a quarter wavelength with ordinary coax, so to speak. You didn't do anything to it. And then you create this coil closer to the shack. So now it is a true half-wave dipole antenna in free space. Center conductor is the upper quarter wave. The shield is the lower quarter wave. You're choking off the RF energy with the coil at the bottom of the antenna, and you're resonating that coil. And now you're mechanically feeding this dipole from the outer tip, but electronically you're feeding the dipole from the center. And it's a slightly unbalanced dipole. In other words, one half of the dipole is center conductor, the other half of the dipole is shield, a little bit larger in diameter. Wavelength-wise, that's a very little difference, not to worry about it. And so you can hang this thing horizontally, vertically, slanted, whatever, but you can hang it with a piece of rope from any high support you've got, slanted at any angle you like, build multiple of them in order to build a phased array by feeding them in various combinations. An extremely effective antenna. And I'm saying, let me drop, that the capacitor that you put across those five turns of coax cable at the bottom end of the dipole, that doesn't have to be a air variable capacitor or a fixed transmitting capacitor in a shielded box. They show it in the diagram as a air variable capacitor to hit resonance. It can be a fixed transmitting capacitor, and you force the resonance by stretching or shrinking the turns of the coils to change the inductance to make it hit resonance with your grid dip meter. Or the next level of smarts in this thing, which wasn't in the article yet, is you make that transmitting level capacitor out of a stub of coax cable. And if you're real smart, there's probably a way that everything stays weatherproof because you use T connectors at the right spot on that coil. I think there's ways you can do that. And by the way, one other nice thing about this article is that they showed you the real equivalent circuit network of a half-wave dipole. It's a series resonator, capacitor, inductor, and resistor with another capacitor across the whole network. So for nearby frequencies, where the half-wave dipole is resonant, that is an equivalent circuit for a half-wave dipole. I've never seen that. I'm sure it must be published in a number of places, but that's a very handy circuit if you want to be able to predict the resistive component and the reactive component of a half-wave dipole, and you're not using the classic curves that are in the antenna handbooks, the radio, antenna engineering handbook, the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Now you've got a equivalent circuit for a half-wave dipole, and you can now predict what its impedance is going to be at a lot of nearby frequencies. There are times when that could be very handy. Quite a nice article, as you can tell. And with any further questions or comments on this article, on this half-wave dipole, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
WA2VDH with a question.
Go right ahead, John.
If you were to use this up at higher frequencies, let's say 6 meters or 2 meters, would you still have to have that capacitor to resonate that coil, or would just the turns, a couple of turns of coax suffice for choking? Go ahead.
It's a good question, John. If you're a purist, you would resonate it. But because at VHF and UHF frequencies, we now can create in a smaller package a hell of a lot more inductance. Could you do it with a pure, just wrapping the coil? The answer is absolutely yes. It would be a slight compromise in the performance, but there's ways you can compensate that. Because the outer tip of a half-wave dipole, where the center impedance is around 72 ohms, and the outer tip, if you wanted to feed it there, is more like 1,500 or 2,000 ohms. The real impedance of the outer tip of a dipole, where the voltage is a maximum, is something like 2,000 ohms. When you create a choke there, you want the choke to be very high in inductive reactance compared to 2,000 ohms. You'd like it to be 20,000 ohms. That's a lot more turns of cable, but at the UHF frequency, that's not very much cable. So you could do that. And yes, you're going to get a little bit of current flowing through that inductor because you haven't perfectly resonated it. You're going to have a little bit of current flowing down the outside of the transmission line. You can compensate for that by putting some ground plane radials there if you wanted to. Or you could ignore it because it's so small in percentage and readjust the lengths of the dipole accordingly to bring things back into resonance. Or make the coil a little bit bigger, a little bit smaller to resonate it. The purist will resonate it. But you're absolutely right. At UHF frequencies where you can create such big inductors so much easier, you don't absolutely have to. Over to you, John. WA2VDH, good question. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, fine business, because it sounds interesting, because I'm at 2 meters or higher, you could build a couple of these and be very interesting for phased a phased vertical arrays. Okay, I appreciate that very much, Dick. Thanks.
As you guys start building these things and start experimenting with them, please come back and let us know what you find. Okay, the next person who asked a question was Press, Whiskey 2 Papa Whiskey. Hope we haven't put you to sleep, Press. Go right ahead with your question or comment. K2LIW on the TechNet.
I'm actually going to tail end a question on the first topic, if you can hear me. How much coax relatively are we talking about in that stub, let's say on 40 meters?
Okay, if you made the stub exactly a quarter wavelength long, which would be 16 feet of coax cable, not counting the velocity factor, that would be equivalent to making a capacitor of infinite capacitance. You're going to be using less than a quarter wavelength of length to make it a real capacitor. I'm going to guess it's going to be in the vicinity of 8 feet of coax cable in that stub. Go ahead.
That's 8 feet at 40 meters. Is it like an eighth of a wave or something?
Okay. An eighth of a wave will give you a predictable amount of capacitance. I can't calculate that one mentally right now. And by the way, once you realize how many picofarad you're simulating with the stub, and the stub is going to be less than a quarter wave long, eighth of a wave is a possibility. Therefore, there is some given number of turns of the coax cable of the coil that gives you the right amount of inductance that resonates with that. So as you make the stub closer and closer to a quarter wave long, the equivalent capacitance starts going toward infinity. frequency at exactly a quarter wave of open circuit stub. The open circuit quarter wave away looks like a perfect short circuit. A perfect short circuit is another way of saying an infinite capacitor. Make it a tiny bit shorter, and it's a zillion picofarads, if you know what I mean. So you can balance between the number of wavelengths, the fraction of a wavelength of the stub, less than a quarter wave, versus the number of turns of coils that you want to make. As the stub approaches quarter wave, the amount of inductance you need in the coil starts getting smaller and smaller. So there's a trade-off here. How many turns of coax cable do you want versus how close do you want to come to quarter wave of stub? Never will the stub be more than quarter wave. Never will the coil be more than 6 or 7 turns on a plastic soda bottle. I think you see the trade-off here, John. And I got to do a little more calculating to figure out some of these variables, but you see how to do the calculation. Once a guy knows how to use a Smith chart or the calculation, X equals Z0 tan theta, in other words, by way of that trigonometric formula and the knowing the impedance of the coax cable, you can figure out exactly how much reactance you're creating, capacitive, reductive.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And I said tangent theta, I think it's cotangent theta, but you see the principle. So I wonder if that makes some sense, that there's a trade-off now between length of stub and the amount of turns of coax required to resonate it. W2 VDH, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine. I think you meant to pass it over to the other gentleman who had the question. Go ahead.
I'm sorry about that. I thought it was you that asked that one, John, or maybe it was press. W2 Papa Whiskey, go right ahead.
I got a comment also, Dick.
You're on the list. Press first. Go ahead, press.
Okay, well, the topic is different, so if you want to take that comment and come right back to me, that's fine.
Okay, so I guess I created a little bit of confusion there. John wanted to know how long should the stub be, and the answer is going to be less than quarter wave, and there's a trade-off between length of stub and number of turns of the coil that does the resonating with the stub. Go ahead, Mel. I wonder if you've built things like this, Mel. I wonder if you've seen this in the latest issue of QEX. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Roger. This is K2KEY. I surely have made similar antennas. In fact, that's what I did. I stubbed, instead of using a tuning capacitor, I wound up using a piece of cable, and I found that a piece of the cable that I was using at the time had exactly measured 21 PF per foot, Dick, over.
Hold on now. The 21 PF per foot is a good number to use if and only if the stub is a very small fraction of a wavelength long. As the stub approaches a quarter wavelength in length, the simple formula 20, 22 or 27 picofarad per foot breaks down. It becomes much too conservative. If I choose a quarter wavelength of cable at, let me pick a number, 40 meters. 40 meters, I think a quarter wavelength of cable is 32 feet long. 32 feet long at 27 picofarad per foot is going to come up with a couple of hundred picofarads. When the cable hits a quarter wavelength in length as an open circuit stub, the equivalent electronic capacitance is an infinite number of picofarads. So that formula of 20 some odd picofarad per foot is only true when the stub is a very small fraction of a wavelength of coax, much shorter than quarter wave. I know this is not an easy one to accept the first time you hear it. I wonder if it makes some sense, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'll tell you exactly what happened. I was building it for 160 meters for a receiving system, and I needed a distributed capacitance of 400 plus, I think around 420 PF. So I used the cable that I measured 21 PF per foot and got the appropriate length. I think it wound up what I wound up with. I forgot how many feet exactly, but I remember that distinctly, that my final measurement was 420 PF, Dick, over.
I'm doing the calculation right now. 420 PF, and I think you said it was 27 picofarad per foot. 27 picofarad per foot means 15 feet. 15 feet of length of cable on a frequency where the wavelength is, let me think, 130, 260, 260 times 2. I'm having trouble with simple mathematics here tonight. So a wavelength on 160 meters is around 520 feet. You used roughly 15 feet of cable. You were using 2% of a wavelength. Absolutely. Under those circumstances, Mel, using X number of picofarad per foot is exactly accurate enough. You were so shy of a quarter wavelength, you weren't running into this other rule that I'm talking about. But that X number of picofarad per foot for coax cable is only for a very small fraction of a wavelength. You start approaching a quarter wavelength of cable, and that formula goes out the window. You got to use another formula. And the good news is you get a lot more picofarads out of the stub as you approach quarter wavelength. Therefore, you don't need anywhere near as much cable as you thought you did. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the deck, man.
Roger. No, it was 21 picofarad per foot. I did the approximate inductance I measured. And I did this all on a Smith chart when I laid it out. My approximate inductance came out to 15 microhenries. So, as you said, this was an idea. I was trying to make a small transmitting loop for one of the receiving end. I described this thing once before. I worked this thing out for, you can make them foam at just about any frequency. But the idea was that was the problem. Where you're going to, you know, they were showing expensive, you know, transmitting vacuum variables. I said, what I need that for? I use coax cable, Dick. Over.
Very crafty. And I just did the recalculation. You wanted 420 picofarads. Your particular cable, maybe it was 75-ohm cable, 21 picofarad per foot. You used 20 feet of cable. 20 feet of cable is 3.8% of a wavelength long at 160 meters. That's a fancy way of saying you were 13.7 degrees long, where 360 degrees is one full wavelength. So a quarter wavelength, where all this magic starts happening, is 90 degrees long. You were 13.7 degrees. You were very shy of a quarter wavelength. You didn't run into this other nonlinear phenomena that I'm talking about, which, again, you could have done it on a Smith chart. You take an open circuit, the right-hand side of a Smith chart, and you walk away from it exactly a quarter wavelength, which means you're going to the exact opposite side of the Smith chart. An open circuit becomes a short circuit. The equivalent capacitance goes to infinity, or the capacitor reactance goes to zero. Rate it any way you like. So know that you can make very high power transmitting capacitors out of a length of RG8 cable, we'll say. You have to weatherproof the end to make sure the water doesn't crawl down it. And you might have to do something to make sure it doesn't arc over at the open circuit end. But you can make some very big transmitting capacitors with a stub of coax cable. And weatherproofing that is a lot easier than weatherproofing an air variable capacitor out in the open breeze. Anybody with any further questions or comments? K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY, one more thing.
Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, you're very right, because you've got to understand, this is something that I have to explain, and I don't think everybody really understood what the situation is. But you have to stay within the confines of 0.1 wavelength at that at the frequency. So when you're using, as you say, a conductor of cable, say, 20 feet long, you are approximately at 0.037 wavelength. So that's way with the 21 PF. With 20 feet, as you said, you'll get 420 PF, and you'll have an inductance of around 15 microhenries. So if you look on a Smith chart, everything sort of falls right into place, Dick. Over.
Yeah, And now, I'll admit that some of the people listening to what you and I are just saying, Mel, are not going to have complete understanding of it. How is